Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, welcome back. First, it's our custom to go around the room and introduce ourselves. But before I do that, is there anyone either online or in person who's new to GBF, first time at GBF, or back after a long absence? Let me see. I'll give anybody online. Okay. Well, welcome everyone. We'll go around the room and hear live and say our names. My name is Grisha.
My name is Henry.
Jim.
Jerry.
Stephen.
Marty.
Ian.
George.
I'm Richard.
Jeff.
I'm Tony.
My name is Cass.
All right, and now I'm going to introduce Bob. So Bob Stahl has founded 8 mindfulness-based stress reduction programs in medical centers in the San Francisco Bay Area and is currently offering programs at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View, California. He serves as assistant professor of the practice in the Department of Behavioral and Social Sciences in the School of Public Health at Brown University Mindfulness Center, and formerly at the OASIS Institute for Mindfulness-Based Professional Education and Training at the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Bob teaches mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher trainings and insight mindfulness meditation retreats worldwide, and is the former guiding teacher at Insight Santa Cruz and a visiting teacher at Spirit Rock and Insight Meditation Society. He's a co-author of 5 books, A Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook, first and second editions, Living with Your Heart Wide Open, Calming the Rush of Panic, A Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook for Anxiety, and Mindful MBSR Every Day. And his website is www.mindfulnessprograms.com. So with that, I'm going to spotlight and turn it over to you, Bob. Take it away.
Thank you all very much. And can you hear me okay? Okay. So it's an honor to be here. I really had I don't know if I'm going to call it a good time last time I was here, but it was a good time. And this last time I was sharing about a very deep practice that I've worked with for many years called the 32 Parts of the Body Meditation, which is found in the first foundation of mindfulness of the body. And today, what I want to speak about is something very close and tender to my heart. And I've been doing a particular practice of reconciliation, making peace with the practice of bringing that with mindfulness for a number of years. And my wife and I, we've actually done retreats and classes with this as well. This is both very important to us. My wife is a retired hospice nurse and also a hospice chaplain. So she's been extensively around the work of death and dying since for many years, 30, 40 years. And I myself have been involved with mindfulness. And actually what really brought me to the practice of meditation was the realization when I was 4 years old that nothing's going to last, that I and everyone is going to die. So this has been a very big practice of mine. And this is what clearly brought me on to the spiritual path, was this awareness of dying. And by this point in my life, of course, I've experienced a lot of near and dear ones and people I know that have passed on. And as I'll read you this powerful reading from Jane Kenyon. She wrote, I got out of bed on 2 strong legs. It might have been otherwise. And he ate cereal, sweet milk, and ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood, and all morning I did the work that I love, and at noon I lied down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls, and I planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know it will be otherwise. I planned another day just like this day, but one day I know it will be otherwise. So this has been a very close and very powerful practice for me through these years, like a thread. And William Stafford, a very beloved American poet, this is his last poem that he wrote. This was 3 days before his death. He knew that he was dying. This is his last poem. He says, there's a thread you follow and it goes among the things that change, but it doesn't change. And people wonder about what you're pursuing and you have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see it. But while you hold on to it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die. You suffer. You get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding, but you don't ever let go of the thread. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding, but you don't ever let go of that thread. The thread of our lives, the thread of the Dharma, the thread of awakening, the thread of wisdom, the thread of compassion. And perhaps in the end, what matters most is how much we've loved and try to live with as much integrity as that we can. And there's a beautiful old saying, I don't know who coined this, but it's something like, you know, every saint has had a past and we all got futures. And when we look back at our life and what we've done, it's a lot. And I'm now approaching my 70th year, and a lot of deep embedded conditioning, karma, reactivity, my stories, my narratives, my conditioning, my beliefs, my identifications are very well deeply ingrained and embedded. And, you know, and I look back at this story of life, it's not always so peachy, rosy, creamy. There's places where I feel ashamed how I've reacted to myself or to others, to this world. And so to me, what is very close to my heart, as I shared earlier with my wife also, we teach about this, is making peace with our lives, with our hearts. And through the years, we've really identified three or four particular areas that feel very worthy, very important to work upon. The first area is making peace to the times I've been hard on myself. The second is making peace or reconciling. I don't know, whatever word that you want to use. Forgiveness, reconciliation, making amends, making peace, balancing the ledger. You know, we each have our own descriptors that perhaps feel more resonant than another. So if I'm not using a word that feels resonant with you, you can retranslate it into your own heart and what language does make sense to you. But the sense of making peace or reconciling to the times I've been hard on myself, making peace, reconciling, making amends to the times that I have hurt others, knowingly or unknowingly. The third area, making amends, reconciling to those that have hurt me. And the fourth area perhaps is a little bit more global in the sense of making peace to the life that I got, to the body that I'm in, to the situations that happened. So this feels like a very big undertaking, and I've been working on this for many years, and it may be an ongoing work. And occasionally when there's blindness, I'm creating new karma of resentments and shame as well. So this is a everyday practice. So I'd like to unpack these particular areas that are very close to me, that feel very important. And so this making peace or making amends to the times I've been hard on myself, and this didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of our conditioning. Some of us perhaps had been brought up in certain types of environments that led to us feeling unworthy or inadequate, we're damaged goods, we're not beautiful. As a friend of mine's father used to call him, you're not like King Midas, that everything you touch turns to gold. You're more like King Minos, and everything you touch breaks. And that's a horrendous thing to say to a child. But there's things that have been said to us early on. We don't know any better because we're like a piece of clay that is getting shaped. It is getting conditioned. We're still learning our identity. We're developing our personality. This happens early on. And if we're brought up in an environment where it feels like, I think my parents used to say, good thing you have your brother because you're not going to make much money. Well, they were right. But that's okay. I'm doing okay. It's not like I'm starving. I mean, take a look around. There's a lot worse off. But there's stories perhaps that we have been told early on in life that we don't know any better. We learn. We develop our identity. I love Popeye's autonomy. I am what I am because that's the way I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. And that's beautiful. On one hand, he's announcing his sovereignty. But on another hand, it can be like there's nothing else to be seen. I'm remembered of one of my very first spiritual teachers, Rod Serling from the Twilight Zone. And there was this one episode when I saw I was a kid that haunted me. And it's a story of this guy that's pretty grumpy. And he's always got a critical comment towards everything and everyone. And he used to have this expression, if everyone would just be like me, the world would be a better place. And so there's a story of him living his day-to-day life, and he's just always with that attitude. And then one night he was going to sleep, and that was the last thought that he had before he went to sleep. And when he woke up, everyone looked like him and talked like him. And that's when the show ended. Do-do-do-do. You get what you put out. So in early childhood, we become conditioned with our environment and we begin to identify. And some of the stories that we have grown up with and that we believe to be true may or may not be true. This is, I think, one of the most incredible gifts of mindfulness practice, is that we're beginning to, rather than looking ourselves along with self-referencing the old stories, habitual patterns, we're beginning to develop self-awareness to begin to see the patterns that we've been hitting our heads with against the walls all these years. And with that possibility of awareness, we can potentially begin to make some change. So there's some hope here. Once we awaken, once we become aware. The conditioning, though, is very strong, and the beliefs are very strong. It's almost as if there's already been a jury, there's already been a court case, there's been a determination. The mallet has hit the table, and you have been condemned to a life sentence of this belief in our own deficiency or inadequacy. But our practices of mindfulness can begin to awaken. Look at this story that I've told myself. The way that I speak to myself, if I spoke this way to my friends and my family, I wouldn't even have any friends anymore. The amount of violence that we say to ourselves. I remember once in an MBSR class, it was about the fifth weekend, and we were doing some practices, and we were going around a circle, and people were sharing some things they were learning about themselves through practicing mindfulness. And one older woman, probably about the age that I am now, 69, almost 70, she said, I realized the other day as I was meditating that I can't remember one single day in my entire adult life that I didn't call myself an asshole. And then another person said, well, I don't call myself that, but I call myself a dummy. And then it started going around the circle of the names that people were identifying with as himself was like, wow, these things we wouldn't say to others. the narratives and the stories, because of the wounding that has happened so early on, that begins to develop a trait, is hard to shake off. We've got the evidence, we've been condemned. But so this making peace with the times we've been hard on ourselves is a very powerful practice to make amends. Perhaps one of the allies too, as well as awareness, is as we can begin to look back with perspective. Sometimes I like to call this hindsight wisdom. We're looking back and we can see more clearly why we believed that we were damaged goods, why we were inadequate because of what happened. Of course I would believe that, but this perspective now, as I see later, begins to bring some light of awareness. So this is a very powerful work to begin to recognize what we have learned. And, you know, as babies, we came in, you know, from the Dharma point of view, there's maybe some dispositional tendencies that even supported, of course, his birth and the karma that brought to it. But also on another hand, we're pretty open slates. And it's just amazing, you know, very young, we didn't experience bias or prejudice. I have a grandson who's 2.5 now, so I can begin to see he's developing some likes and not likes. Of course, he said, we're human and preferences and ideas about things. But earlier on, like, you know, he could be in front of all of you and just take a poop or a pee or throw up or laugh or cry. And he don't even care what any of you think because he's just being baby. And babies, you know, they're just, it's just what they do. And there's something so innocent and beautiful. But then we begin to learn. I remember once at the beach, my son was naked on the beach. He was about maybe 2 or 3 years old. And some kids walked by and they started laughing at him. Look at him. He's naked. Look at him. He's naked. And my son didn't even know what they were talking about. It's like it's later we begin to learn and then we begin to get shamed. Shame is such a painful thing. I remember my uncle, when we were growing up, we would go to my grandmother's house on Sundays afternoons quite often. And my grandmother wants to please everyone. And she'd always have some peanuts out on the little table. And I liked peanuts. And so I'd come and I'd get some peanuts. And my uncle began to see this was kind of a pattern. I'd come in, say hello to everyone. I'd go get some peanuts. And so he thought this was kind of funny. And then he used to start to begin to make an announcement to everyone in the family. Here comes the claw. Here comes the claw. You know, I knew enough even at this early age that I didn't have claws. I had fingers. And somehow the way that he said that, all the attention was brought to me. I felt shame. I did not want to be seen. And as time went on, I'd come in. I wouldn't go near the peanuts. I just want to kind of disappear because I didn't want Uncle Sidney to say, here comes the claw. These like, it took years for me to realize, wow, I'm carrying around this wounding from Uncle Sidney calling me a claw. And perhaps some type of belief that, you know, it is being an animal a bad thing? It's like some type of connotation of shaming. And we get imprinted at an early age. We get very imprinted. We begin because we're developing our identification. We don't know any better. I have a dear friend of mine who's a Buddhist nun, and early in her life, she was, I won't go into the graphics, but horrible conditions growing up of abuse, and it's just horrible. But, and I remember once we were talking about this, and she said, you know, I didn't know that this was, I thought every kid, this was happening in every home. It's only later that you realize, wow. And so like this conditioning happens at times when we don't even know. But now here we are. We're Dharma practitioners. We're practicing developing greater self-awareness. And so we begin to turn on that light of awareness and whoa, what did we see? The Bob show ad nauseum and the Chris show and George show and everybody's show ad nauseum. It just goes around and around the stories. They said, she said, he said, why is it, you know, like this and that? And it's like, wow. The stories, the narratives, the experiences that we've had. So powerful to begin to awaken, to begin to see the stories, to begin to see the ways that I deal with myself and so forth. So perhaps this is the beginning steps towards some type of mediation, so some type of making amends. Like, what would it be like if I could begin to actually hold myself with greater kindness now that I understand more why it is that I've been so unkind to myself. So the understanding is crucial. It's great that we have these practices of self-compassion. I can put my hand on my heart. That's really good. But we got to know why we're putting our hand on the heart, because we have this belief that I'm no good. Where did that belief in no good come from? Came from earlier times, earlier conditioning, and so forth. So developing our understanding of these stories, these narratives, these beliefs, these identifications that develop into conditioning, that develops into deeper embedded conditioning. But as we awaken, we can begin to see this more clearly, to perhaps begin to learn from it. Perhaps begin, as Derek Walcott from this beautiful poem, Love After Love, says, that the time will come when with elation you'll greet yourself arriving at your own door and in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. And you will love again the stranger who is yourself. Such the beginning of the healing journey, beginning to meet ourselves with greater compassion, with greater understanding and insight, and what was fueling and driving this such a firm belief in my own no goodness, if you will. So this is a very powerful practice to begin to make amends to the times I've been hard on myself. And the greatest gift towards that is understanding what's fueling and driving this. As we sit with ourselves, this may become more clear. Another area that I want to speak about is making amends to the times I've been hard on others. This is actually an area that's very difficult for a number of us to even admit that we cause some pain to another. It's difficult. Like we know all the people that have been the difficult ones in our lives and perhaps don't want to look at that. Perhaps we have been a difficult one to another. So this is an important area in the sense of beginning to make some pieces. How do I begin to reconcile to these times that I've caused some pain to another? And of course, some of the pain that we may have caused to another, this person may not be on the planet anymore. They may have passed on. But I want to affirm that I believe that it's very possible to continue to heal whether a person that you've hurt is alive or gone. Because the healing has to do with our own heart. Two qualities to bringing on healing to those that I've hurt. Three more. But one is to actually acknowledge that this is true. Sometimes it's knowingly, sometimes it's unknowingly. We speak about intention and impact. Sometimes we don't know the pain we've caused another. But our awareness is a great ally. At least we're beginning to develop humility and to understand, I've caused some pain to another. And then there's a couple of other things that I feel are very important. And one is if it feels right, feels appropriate, offering a very sincere apology that's authentic and genuine. And maybe if they're not close by, but they're still on the planet, I can just do this even as a ritual inside me. And I apologize genuinely, authentically for the times that have caused some pain to another. So that's one facet. And another one that I think is very important in the Dharma, there's a couple of Pali words, hiri otapa. Sometimes it can be translated as working with your conscience with shame and dread. But there's a much more poetic expression that really speaks much more to my heart. It's called becoming a guardian of the world. And so what that means is that when you recognize that you've caused some pain to another, that not only perhaps if you have the opportunity to make that sincere apology, genuine apology, but then you really bring it to your forefront in your heart that you make your deepest and sincerest effort to try not to repeat that again. That's how it gets paid back. I learned this a lot with my sons, you know, growing up. I wasn't always the father that I wanted to be. Sometimes I was not so skillful. Sometimes I hurt their feelings. I took away their sovereignty. But when I recognized that, I'd come back to my son and I'd look at him in his heart and I would apologize to him genuinely. But then I realized that what would make that apology real is to really try not to do the thing again that I'm apologizing for. Because, you know, and all too often, you know, you're sorry, and then you do it again. You're sorry, you do it again. You're sorry, you do it again. And so to really begin to work with changing, like I really made a commitment. I don't want to go down this road again of shaming him or whatever it is. So this thing of, that's why this beautiful expression, becoming a guardian of the world, is that now I'm becoming a protector because I'm no longer sowing those seeds of shame or making someone feel smaller or hurting someone. So not only is the authentic and genuine apology important, but the commitment, as best we can, because we're human, of trying not to repeat that action that caused such pain. And then it becomes, I'm becoming a guardian, becoming a protector. There's a very beautiful story that I'll share with you, a powerful story. There's an American Zen priest, his name is Claude Shin Thomas. He wrote a book called At Hell's Gate. And I actually heard him give a Dharma talk once, and I was blown away with his story. You know, when I first saw him, he was kind of a smaller in stature man with a shaved head and robes. I had no idea of his history or his background. And then he opened up his mouth. And I had all these, maybe these judgments or whatever, you know. And then he opened up his mouth and started to talk. And this is what he's sharing, is that, prior to being a monk, he grew up in a military family, and he enlisted into the Vietnam War to serve his country. And he became a machine gunner on helicopter missions in Vietnam. You know, and he says, make no mistake, when you get enlisted into the army and during wartime, you are instructed to, my job literally was to kill human beings. But they weren't human beings. They were just objects to be eliminated. He's very, no flowery words here. And he said that, you know, I was really good at this because there was bets. If you came back from a mission, you had the most kills, you would get a bag of heroin. You'd get a bag of cocaine. You'd get a bag of this, a bag of that. And he said, I won a lot of those contests. By the end of the war, I had killed over 350, because I kept count, over 350 men, women, and children. Got discharged, ended up around the Pittsburgh area, homeless, drug addict, living out on the streets. And some social worker would bring him food, and they began to develop a connection, and she saw something in him. And she said, after a while, she said, there's this meditation retreat coming up, workshop. I want you to go. And he'd laugh, say, I ain't going anywhere. And then she'd come back again, say, I want you to go. And can't. So this went on for quite some time. I guess the workshop, the retreat was quite a ways off, but she kept on bugging him to go. And he kept on saying no. She's just kept on bugging me so much that I realized that the only way that she would stop bugging me is I say, I'll go. So I decided I'll go. And he went, because she made it happen for him after a long time. And so he went to this retreat, and it was filled with other Vietnam veterans like himself that had been through the war And as each veteran began to share their story, he could see that he was with people like him. The person facilitating this was a Vietnamese monk. His name was Thich Nhat Hanh. And he, at the end of this retreat, Claudius and Thomas had a powerful transformation and decided to start a meditation practice. He got into a halfway house. He began to get off drugs and begin to go into rehab. And then he heard about the Zen Peacemaker Order that was founded by Bernie Glassman. And there's something about how Zen was being taught there that felt very resonant with him. And so he began practicing with Bernie Glassman's order and became a student. And after a period of time, he said to Bernie that he would like to be ordained as a Buddhist monk. And so this has now been a number of years, and he's now no longer an addict, a using addict. And Bernie said, I will ordain you. And Bernie has done also a lot of work in Europe, helping with concentration camp survivor children of Nazis, and bringing people together in retreats and doing reconciliation work. And so Bernie had these connections in Europe, and Bernie decided that I am going to ordain you, but I'm going to ordain you because of your past in a very particular place. And so what they did was they flew to Poland and to Auschwitz, and on the train platform of where people were pointed to, either to the concentration camp or to the gas chambers, they did the ordination ceremony at that train platform, where he became a Buddhist monk. And then, Lab said in kind of this humorous way, I took a left and I began to walk. And I walked over land from Auschwitz to Saigon in Vietnam. It took me 1.5 years to walk there. And every single bit of the way, whoever would be open to listening, I would share with them what it was like to have killed 350 men, women, and children. Since this time, Claude has traveled all over the world. I was teaching a retreat in Colombia in 2017, and I was telling the story about Claude and Tom, and then one of my hosts said, oh yeah, he was here just a year ago doing some teaching. And so like Claude has dedicated his life. He's become like a guardian of the world. From this soldier who had killed over 350 men, women, and children to now a protector of people. And he knows from the inside, he has to live every day with knowing what it is that he had done. And what saves him and gives him meaning is to help prevent that from ever happening again. This is a very dramatic story of making peace to the times I've caused pain to others. This is how he's become a guardian of the world. There's actually an old Buddhist story, I won't go into it now, of Angulimala, who was a murderer that transformed himself and became an arahant during the time of the Buddha. Looking at the clock, I'm going to proceed on. But I'm very inspired with Claude Shin's story of how he could turn around the horror. You know, when first he was kind of brainwashed, I'm just doing what my country told me to do. But then afterwards, waking up and seeing what he'd done, but then dedicating the rest of his life to making peace, reconciling to the times I've caused pain to another. So the third area is beginning to reconcile to the times others have hurt me. This is very difficult. But there's perhaps a couple of ways that we can work with this. And just perhaps as we've been reflecting in this journey, just as I've been hard on myself with the beliefs that I'm a no good, deficient, ugly, whatever person you want to say, and also feeling a lot of guilt and pain for the pain that I've caused others, but perhaps we begin to understand that those that hurt me that it came from their own unawareness, their own conditioning, their own woundedness. I also want to say right away, it may not excuse the actions to the degree that, you know, you've been hurt. Some of us have been hurt terribly, but perhaps it brings some understanding of what, like, oh, it's due to their unawareness, their fear, their pain. It's interesting. Norman Fisher, who some of you may know, Zen poet and teacher, he wrote a book called a kind of a translation of the Bible Book of Psalms, but written from kind of like a Buddhist interpretation. And one of the very clever things that he did, because in old biblical language, a lot of the descriptor words is this person was unrighteous, they were evil, they were bad, they were wicked. So what he did was he took out all those words and he wrote instead that they were heedless, they were not mindful, they were unaware. That kind of changes the context. They were unaware. They were not mindful. It was ignorance, not knowing. So perhaps, it may not excuse the actions, but beginning to understand, just as I have the beliefs of my own deficiency and I'm hurt on myself and I've caused also pain to others, so too others that hurt me, that it came out of their own unawareness, their own fears, their own conditioning. But the other very important facet that I think is incredibly important is that we suffer a lot, or I know I have suffered a lot through those that have hurt me. The building up of resentment and grudges and ill will is so painful to live with. I'm pointing the finger, you fucked me over, but there's three fingers coming back at me. Like, how do I begin to take responsibility? Like, otherwise, I'm just going to be filled with resentment and grudges for the rest of my life and be buried that way. Like in the spirit of my own well-being, how can I begin to neutralize the resentments that I'm harboring and holding? I think this is very important. This is something that we can't change the actions that happen, but I can change perhaps how I am with it, that I can begin to neutralize some of these resentments and grudges, because they are just so painful to live with day in and day out. Reminded of another story that I'll share with you, and this is when I was referring to that I was in Colombia. I was teaching a retreat there outside of Bogota, and my friend and host, she decided she wanted to bring my wife Jan and I to this one particular place to see. And I asked her about it, and she said, we'll just go and you'll see for yourself what it is. And so she brought us to this place where there was an outer shell of a building that had been torn down. Maybe there was just like a foundational wall around it, and you could see right through it in that there was a newer building inside that. And it was mostly of glass and a roof, a few white walls, and a lot of black floor. And I said, where are you taking us? And she just smiled. And then she pointed to the sign that said, silence only, no speaking. And so we go into this building and there's just all these black floors and white walls and a roof. And it's just in the signs, silence. I had no idea what are we doing in here? What is this about? And I'm just being open, just walk around. And then there's one inner room that you could walk into, and there was a video playing. And so eventually my wife and I went in there, and it was in Spanish, but it was fortunately subtitled in English. And it was a story of this artist named Doris Solidia, who was commissioned to this project. Some of you may know Colombia has had over 50 years of wars and insurgency and drug cartels and militias. And one of my good friends there, like she grew up and her mom would say, be careful of the holes where the bombs have created holes in the streets. I mean, and it was very powerful to know that like whenever we drove anywhere in Colombia, wherever you parked in big parking lots, you always would back in. And I've said to my friend, why are we always backing in? Can't we just drive in? He goes, you never know how fast you have to get out. We always back our cars in because we don't know. We may have to, like, that's the type of consciousness that's there. So there's been these 50 years plus of unrest, and some years ago, a peace treaty was signed. It was historic with the militias and the narcos and the military. There was some peace treaty that was signed, and as a gesture of really making that real, there was an agreement that everyone would give away their guns as a symbolic gesture of making peace. And so these guns were collected and they were melted down, and they were melted into these very big sheets. And then they were cut about 1 meter square, 3 feet by 3 feet or so. And then they were fastened to a floor. So that big black floor we were walking on was all made out of guns. And in the videos explaining all of this, Doris invited many of the women and some men that had been violated, treated terribly during the war, to be part of this project. Because after they were, these guns were melted and they were into these sheets, they were cut into the, again, like 1 meter square. Then they had to be pounded, shaped in certain ways so they could be fastened to the floor. And so there was interviews of these women, some men, pounding these sheets that were made of these guns. And some of them were crying, and someone said, I have held on to this resentment and grudges for years. It is making me sick. I have gastrointestinal problems. My heart is high blood pressure. I've just been filled with so much hate and resentment, and I'm just pounding, and they're crying. And it was just like this image of people beginning to heal and to like realizing like what I've been holding inside me has been so poisonous. Beginning to make peace to the times others have caused pain to me, to begin to reconcile. The very powerful image, seeing those women and some men crying and just acknowledging how they've had years and years of resentment and grudges and hate, and that it's just been so toxic to their hearts that it was time to begin to neutralize. You could see them at the end holding each other, crying and laughing. The possibilities of our human heart begin to heal. And it's not like a light switch on and off. Okay, now I'm healed again. I mean, we have strong conditioning and this amnesia, but at least with our practice, we begin to remember. Remembering again our place in this universe. Our right to be here, no more so, no less so than any other sentient being. Remembering. So this last area, making peace to the life I got. Maybe we're not going to become a movie star or be in the best rock and roll band or be whatever. Like, how do we begin to make peace or reconcile to the life that I do have, to the body that I'm in, to the here or no here that you have, to the size of your body, to your gender, to your sexual orientation, to your political affiliation, to the life that we have? How do we begin as we come towards, you know, our life, our death? Like, how do we begin to make peace with this life that we have in one way or another? Begin to, so this is perhaps bringing together the reconciling of these first three. The times I've been hard on myself, the times I've caused pain to another, the times that others have caused pain to me, but also with the life that I got. You know, and sometimes we're so, don't like what we got. Like when I grew up, I had really curly hair and I wanted straight hair. And again, like now I have no hair. And some of us had straight hair and really wanted curly hair. Some of us wanted to be big and we were short. Some of us were short and wanted to be big. You know, like it just goes, like you know, have this body or that body. Like this is the body that we got. This is the life that we got. And it doesn't mean we can't try to improve upon it. But sometimes we try to improve on it so much because it comes from a place of insecurity. How do we begin to also meet our own hearts with compassion, with kindness, to appreciate our own beauty? So the sense of reconciling to the life that I have, to the body that I'm in, to the situation that I'm living with. To me, to be able to be on my deathbed and to have made peace with all of this feels like a good job. But maybe it's not like a period, make peace and then okay. But maybe at least I'm on that journey of making peace. And I want to also just recognize, okay, maybe it doesn't have to all be done, but at least I'm sincere enough and genuine enough to know that I'm a work in progress, and can I meet it with greater compassion and love? It feels to me as practitioners, maybe it's not so much about developing all these altered states, but the state of deep understanding, of forgiveness, of compassion, of humility, of kindness to our neighbors, to our friends, to ourselves, to strangers, to this world. Perhaps these are the most important things. So may we remember, and I'll just end with one other reading. I had a lot of them here, but I'll just go with this one. Actually, I'm going to do two. So this is such a beautiful poem. And this poem really is the kernel of the Dharma. It's from Naomi Shihab Nye. Some of you have probably read this poem called Kindness. And when I think about my own teachers, it's really been this legacy of kindness that's been passed on, that may continue to be passed on. And Naomi Shihab Nye, she wrote about this poem that she'll say, I heard her say this, that I didn't write this poem. I was just the scribe. I just had my pen and my paper, and it was almost as if I was just told to write this. And this came out of her being in Colombia on a bus with her husband. They were on a honeymoon. They were traveling from Austin, Texas to the tip of South America. And in Colombia, the bus was pulled over by some militia and everyone was robbed. One person was shot and killed. And then she ended up, after they all left, her and her husband went to this little village and was met by a very kind gentleman and helped them to, you know, find their way. And she said she went out into the plaza that very night, sit on a bench. And this is what she says that she was ascribed to. She says, I didn't write this, but it's called kindness. She says, before you know what kindness is, you must really lose things and feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. And what you held in your hand and what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscapes can be between the regions of kindness. And how you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop and the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out those windows forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where an Indian in a white poncho lies dead on the side of the road, and you must see how this could be you. And how that he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. And you must wake up with sorrow and speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of that cloth. And then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. And then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. It is only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to meal lettuce, precious bread. It is only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. And then it goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. And then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. So I think I'll pause here, looking at the time, and thank you for your hearts and listening, and I hope that some of what was shared touches you. Where are the places where I need to reconcile? To make amends to myself, to those that have caused me pain, to those that hurt me, reconciling with this life. This, to me, seems to be some of the most important of endeavors. Perhaps in time it begins to culminate through seeing through these stories, these conditionings. As the Buddha awakened, he said he experienced the unconditioned. He could only perhaps have experienced the unconditioned through seeing through the conditioning, seeing through the stories. Thank you very much. I wish you well. And see, it's just about noon, but not quite. And it might be too early in this one. Well, you have anything you want to say? Any questions? But I'll open it up if anyone wants to say something.
I suppose we could take a minute for a quick question or two. Anybody have a burning desire?
Bob, please.
I just want to thank you for an extraordinarily extraordinarily connecting thought. I mean, you touched me in so many ways. One message that is with me now, probably forever. One of the things I learned from being with the Buddhist group here is the idea when your life seems to have fallen into a hole, to find things to be grateful for. And the phrase you mentioned in the beginning, and I don't remember the person who said created it, rather than saying, I'm grateful for this or that this has happened, to be able to think of it, what I'm grateful for, but to say it might have been otherwise. And I think that's such a profound, beautiful way to express gratitude. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. All right, we probably should wrap up now. Is there, what are the announcements we have? Yep.
Hi, I'm the host today. So please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. We have some vegan treats, some hot water for tea. If you have tea, put your cup in the sink and we'll take care of it at the end. I'll be coming around with the Donna bowl. Suggested donations, $10 to $20, will help us meet the expenses of paying rent for this place and publishing our newsletter, which goes largely to people who are incarcerated, and paying the expenses of the Sangha. Around 12:30, some people gather at the front door to go to lunch. Some weeks, not everybody's welcome to join
that.
And I think that's all I have today.
Thank you, Cass. Anybody else? Any other announcements? Next week's teacher is Stephen Tierney. Any other announcements? Last week we met and put out the new newsletter. The new newsletter is available on the website, and it also went out to a few hundred mostly incarcerated gay Buddhists and people around. So thank you to those who put that together. Bob, do you have a particular dedication of merit, or would you like us to use ours?
Yeah. Thank you. And
would you say
I did? I would love to invite you to do yours. To do.
Okay. Okay. Cass, do you want to do it? Because I can't find it.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness, which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.